The Startup to Scale Up Game Plan is brought to you by Alpina Search, Europe's premier talent search firm, dedicated to helping technology startups and scale-ups recruit high-impact executives. Now over to your host, Gary Riemann.
Today, we welcome a guest who's at the forefront of the cybersecurity and insurance landscape. Earlier this year, CyberSmart raised a $15 million Series B led by the European SaaS VC Ox for their groundbreaking all-in-one cybersecurity and insurance solution, which is aimed at helping small and medium-sized businesses. And our guest today is Jamie Akhtar, the CEO and co-founder of CyberSmart. So, Jamie, welcome to the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan.
Thank you, Gary. Great to be here.
And looking forward to digging into some of your journey and your vision for the future. And let's start at the beginning, though. Can you tell us about your background and what inspired you to start CyberSmart?
So really, I'd say the first half of my career was very focused on helping other businesses to achieve their dreams and making their dreams come true and their ambitions. And that kind of started with social media, as I mentioned, but evolved into helping companies with everything from digital media to application development, everything kind of technical and internet enabled, really. And that was my passion and still is for a long time. I think technology has an incredibly powerful role in the world of enabling us to access information and to empower future generations. So that's kind of one evergreen thread, and kind of you got to hold that one in your mind as we kind of evolve into cyber, eventually into CyberSmart. So I did that for quite a while, built hundreds of different things, which was a lot of fun. Got travel a lot as well, working with clients across the US and Asia and Europe. So that was great fun. But all this time, I was kind of thinking, and I was wondering, like, what's that one thing, or what's that something I really sink my teeth into? What can I start? What can I grow? What can I build that's like my own? And it took a little while to kind of get there. And it's one of the first lessons, really, in that pre-ideation stage, or when you are kind of thinking about what to do. I think it's really important to reflect and let your experiences build up to a culmination. I think if you see something interesting, let's say generative AI, right? Or let's say climate change, and you're interested in it, it's really not going to be enough for you to have the momentum and energy to go and build something that is novel and sustain that to build a big company out of it. So I think spending the time finding your passion and your purpose and what you really, really get excited about and you're willing to commit the next 10 years of your life, that's the kind of commitment you're signing up to, is very important in that stage. So as time went on, I really got into the more technical side of cybersecurity. So taught myself a lot of stuff from penetration testing and security architecture up to the fun bits, as I like to call it, governance, risk and compliance. So things like ISO auditing. And taken together, cybersecurity is one of the most interesting aspects, I think, in technology, because it feels not only like we're not winning this battle against the criminals and the various things that are sent to testers online, but it's something that's continuously evolving and adapting. And for me, that was a real fascination that kind of sucked me in. And it's, you never really stay still and you never stop learning and the landscape never stops changing. So it's, if you're a curious person, I think cyber is a really interesting space to be. It's also one that's growing incredibly fast on both the impact, so what companies are spending on cyber, but also the negative impacts that we see across governments and businesses of all shapes and sizes. So I think this is probably my pitch for cyber more than anything so far. But essentially, it's for me, I found something I really sink my teeth into. So where it all comes together is take that first stream that parked away, take the second stream, and we were speaking to business about how we can help them to protect themselves and implement good cybersecurity practice. And we were like, almost everything we're doing and saying is repeatable. We seem to be kind of having the same conversations over and over again. And we know from our direct experiences that people really struggle with this, especially small businesses. And we didn't really see, and still today, when I look around, I don't really see many viable alternatives for smaller businesses that want good cyber protection without the hassle. The way that the cybersecurity industry has evolved in many larger organizations, and you might have seen some of the stats around this, average enterprise has 109 different security tools. That's just not going to work for a small business. They want one or two or, you know, a handful of things that they can implement in order to stay on top of cyber, because it's a risk they need to manage, but it's also not the primary aim or purpose of their business, right? It's to deliver whatever services or goods they're producing. So given that, taking all that into context, we set about building a platform that would make cybersecurity simple and accessible for small businesses so they could get started on that journey of understanding, managing, and continuously maintaining a good level of cyber hygiene. And through that process, we kind of came up with across a lot of barriers, really, from education and awareness. And now CyberSmart's coming up 7 years old. Back in the days, 7 years ago, SMBs, the majority of people you surveyed, and they did survey people, wouldn't see cybersecurity as a high risk or a high priority. Now, obviously, that's changed, but there's still a lot of preconceptions, and there still are today, around whether or not businesses or consumers even are a target, or whether or not there's a risk that is worth managing. Even the latest DCMS study shows the median cyber spend is £0. So more than 50% of businesses are nothing at all on cybersecurity. Yet, you know, a lot of them are digitally enabled and do have cyber risk there. So one of the first challenges we needed to solve was, how do you help businesses to understand their cyber risk in a way that doesn't result in you scaring them, really? And the cyber industry is built on fear, uncertainty, and doubt. So FUD, you might have heard this acronym, but a lot of the cybersecurity marketing and the reasons and the way products were sold was through basically scaring people. And if you don't do this, you're going to get hacked and lose all your data and you're going to go out of business type thing. And we wanted to change that conception. We wanted to demystify it and make it a little bit more accessible for businesses and say more on their side rather than trying to sell them solutions. So we set out on this journey a long time ago. One of the earliest things, talking about some of the early stories, when we started, there was four of us. We rented an Airbnb in Cheltenham. We were part of the National Cybersecurity, or GCHQ Accelerator, as it was known back then. It was a first ever cohort. And I remember walking in, because this is like our country's intelligence services doing their first ever program to work with early stage startups. And we walked into this building. It was a well-known training company. And we were given badges for this company. We couldn't tell anyone what we were doing there. Apart from that, we were doing some training. It was a really fascinating experience. But outside of that, for about 3 or 4 months, we lived together, worked together. And, you know, it was pretty much like pitching in the day, because, like, you know, you get gear into an early stage accelerator. It's all about perfecting your pitch, you know, and raising money and stuff like that. But we needed to build a product at the same time. So I was coding in the night, and we were working on the pitch at the day, and we were trying to build some partnerships and get our first customers on board as well. And I think that's a really another kind of key highlight, is that moment you've got, that early stage where you don't have massive external pressures, and, you know, your runway is manageable. Like, effectively, you're kind of living hand to mouth, but as long as you've got some other income or some time and space, I think it's a really magical moment to really figure out, what is the company about? What is it? What is the problem that you're trying to solve? How can you uniquely solve it, given your skills and experience? I would encourage founders to kind of relish in that phase. Don't raise money too early, because you'll look back and you'll be like, oh, I wish we had like more time in that early stage, that formation stage, really, because it does set the tone for the rest of the business and life of the company.
And how did you and your co-founders come together? Did you meet at the accelerator, or were you already working together?
We were already working together. So three of us were working a cybersecurity consultancy, so helping companies deal with cybersecurity day to day, effectively as selling time. So the product was an evolution of that. And one of the founding employees I met in the co-working space where we're currently at Second Home, I met them walking through the building, and we just stayed in touch. And they moved from Austria, moved into this Airbnb in Cheltenham, like upended their whole life to come and, you know, have fun with the early days of CyberSmart.
And tell me about this somewhat unique, I think it possibly is unique, combination of combining cybersecurity with insurance. Did you come up with that approach from the very beginning?
Yeah, so we're like skipping a few steps, but we'll fast forward to kind of product today, I guess. It's definitely not unique, and we're definitely not the pioneers of this. But I'll talk through some of the challenges of this cyber insurance market and kind of what our perspective on that space is. So cyber insurance is relatively nascent, but very fast growing, probably the fastest growing line of insurance. So it has a lot of insurers are very interested in this, and there's a lot of insurtechs that are helping companies to deal with this. The challenge with cyber is it's inherently very difficult to assess risk initially. So when you take something like flood or fire, you can kind of look at historical data and it'll give you a good indication. If you look at something like a hurricane, right, you know whether or not it's at risk of being in that kind of zone. There's a lot more data and there's a lot more insight you can gain before basically riding risk. With cyber insurance, the difference between two companies that look almost identical or look identical on the outside, take a 20-person accountancy firm based in the same town in the rural countryside of England, they can have extremely different risk profiles. One of them could have implemented really good cyber hygiene. They could have a managed service provider taking care of all their IT, all their devices are patched. They've got a remote working policy. So if people do bring their own device, those are also secure. They could be storing all their data in company approved areas like Dropbox or Google Drive, where only the relevant people have access to relevant files. It's quite a detailed description, but that's company A. Company B does absolutely nothing at all when it comes to cybersecurity. People just use whatever device they've got lying around. No one cares about updating. Everyone uses the same password for everything. And all their files are just stored wherever they find it most convenient. So the risk profile is extremely different. And that's something you just don't know. And why CyberSmart's approach is all that data on SMBs actually lives inside the organization. So a lot of the insurtechs are using outside in technology or scanning to assess risk. So, you know, is your website secure and is your email set up correctly? That is like just the surface, tip of the iceberg, really, when it comes to cyber risk for an SMB. So what we do at CyberSmart is we help companies to assess all their cyber hygiene across people, process, and technology, implement good practice and continuous controls in order to make sure that stays there, and only provide them with the insurance after they've achieved all that things. It'd be kind of like going to an insurance saying, hey, can you insure my house? And they're like, have you got locks on your doors? And have you closed your windows? And in the cyber world, they don't really know whether or not all these controls are in place. People obviously attest on a form, but some businesses don't even know themselves. So how do you close that information asymmetry gap? How do you empower customers to understand and manage their cyber risk? And then finally, how do you do that before you provide insurance? So our take on it is you have to protect companies and you have to help them to manage risk before you transfer it. And that's why we're able, and we've been able to bind about 3,000 insurance policies for small business customers because of our unique approach. And that's the bit that's unique, is the kind of protect then insure, whereas almost all the other insurtechs are focused on the risk management sitting alongside the insurance.
And you've been around 7 years. The cybersecurity industry has evolved a lot during that time. There are new threats constantly emerging. Technology is changing so rapidly. How do you stay ahead of the curve and ensure that your solutions remain effective and relevant?
It's a really, really good question. I think the market has changed and some of the fundamentals of it always remained and always will remain. It's far easier for most hacking activity and risk to businesses criminal. So it's looking for financial gain, whether that's extortion or extraction of data that can be sold. With that in mind, criminals tend to target the easiest, the weakest link in the chain and the easiest victims, or in some cases, the larger ones that can pay out larger financial sums, but that effort is proportional to the reward. In our segment, where we're focusing on SMEs, as long as you put in place good cyber hygiene, you basically will reduce your risk by about 90 to 99%, because you're just not worth someone spending the time and effort to craft very detailed, you know, they're not going to waste a 0 day on a small business type thing. So most of the risks for businesses, and actually does apply to large as well, sit within the kind of cyber hygiene bucket. And it's kind of a fallacy, I guess, that the security vendors have created, is that there's these dark, scary unknowns out there that are trying to come for us, and we don't know where or when they're going to come. And it's like, most likely someone's going to have a default password or have not applied a software update, and that's going to be the vector. There's obviously social engineering involved as well. So ensuring that you've got good basics in place will reduce the vast majority of risk is probably the first thing I would say. The second thing is probably a little bit more recent and relevant, is one of my predictions is that we're going to see a lot more sophisticated attacks happen at scale due to the use of things like generative AI. So whereas before you'd have to specifically craft like a spear phishing email to target someone, you can now do that for hundreds or thousands of millions of businesses en masse. And I think that is one of the areas. So we need to make sure the defenses keep up in that respect as well, both technical and human. It's going to be virtually impossible for a regular human to distinguish whether or not an email is real, as we see with things like deepfakes, right? How do you know what's real and what's not? And that means that you have to have really strong systems and processes in place. I'll take a good example and something that we're advising our customers on quite a bit nowadays is financial controls. So making sure that you've got multiple people signing off a payment over a certain threshold. Having that strong process in place is vital, because you don't really know how the attack's going to evolve, but that fundamental process will protect you from the vast majority of things from going wrong.
So do you use generative AI yourselves to develop countermeasures to protect against generative AI threats that are now emerging?
It's an interesting thought experiment. There's a startup actually doing something quite similar, using generative AI to train people against generative AI. I think for the most part, you don't necessarily need generative AI to combat generative AI. If you're looking at things like phishing, you actually need really robust training to make sure people can spot good systems for responding if something does get through, and baseline technical measures to stop it hitting their inbox or being able to execute in the first place. So it's more of a baseline layer defense rather than, in theory, I think you could. And I'm definitely expect things like the email filtering solutions, where, you know, Microsoft, Google, but also the many third-party vendors to start building these kind of capabilities in. For us, the use cases of generative AI are far more around helping people to understand and manage their risk. So in other words, personalizing the experience and making that relevant to the audience, and that particularly smaller business and non-technical users, taking what can be a very technical subject like cyber and trying to explain to them the impact and how they should deal with, you know, maybe they've got 10 things to do, which one do they do first? I think those are the kind of use cases where we can see a lot of value.
And Jamie, how has your role and your leadership style evolved over the past 7 years?
It's a long journey. It's evolved a tremendous, and funny enough, I was writing a personal growth plan this morning. Basically, how's it going to evolve over the next 18 months as we head towards our Series C, and kind of what are the key pillars and the areas I want to focus on? And I think that's something really important to do as a founder. And you can tie it into your funding rounds, you can tie it into annual cycles, but just essentially taking stock of like, okay, where is the business today? Where do I want to get it to in the next 12, 18, 24 months? And how do I need to adapt and change in order to get there? And I guess there's probably some constants, some things that will always be part of the founder's journey. One is letting go. And, you know, as you grow and scale, so this is practically and emotionally, I guess. So practically, you need to bring in people because you don't scale, right? An individual can't scale. So letting go practically from ownership and responsibility, emotionally from areas like product or whatever it is that you're really, it could be sales or marketing, or whatever you're really passionate about, that's probably the hardest one. So I've hung on to those for as long as possible. And now until people kind of, you know, kick you out of the function and say, you're not adding value anymore, you're slowing us down. That's always one is doing that, but also finding the time and space to do the other parts of, there's a great book, I think it's free. It's on Amazon as well, called From Founder to CEO. And I think that's a really nice overview of that journey and what that looks like, about building systems and processes, about empowering your teams with decision-making, about thinking about communication hierarchy and how information flows. And there's definitely kind of trigger points, I guess. And we grew the company mostly in the kind of physical world. Now we're in this hybrid remote first world. But in the physical world, there's kind of a natural limitations to kind of number of people you could effectively communicate with. And, you know, you get like these, I think Amazon call them the two pizza teams or something. But if you've got a small group of people, you know, like 8 or 10 people in the company, everybody knows absolutely everything about what's going on and everyone's always on the same page. And you don't really have alignment issues or miscommunication to that degree. As long as you kind of do have a vision and a strategy and a plan and things aren't going terribly wrong, I think you're broadly all pulling in the same direction. As you start to grow and you get to like 20 people, 30 people, then the cracks start to appear and you realize that everything you put in place to get stuff done really fast and to add customer value and so everybody learns from the customer in parallel and we all understand what we're doing this week, that starts to break down and you need a bit more structure. So I think putting in place more structure around the team and decision-making and things like that are really important. So I think that was a big focus area for me. The other area I pretty much had to learn from scratch is fundraising. Because if you've not run a VC-backed or an angel-backed startup before, then it's a very, very different journey to running a profitable business. And I ran profitable businesses before. The first time I remember we went from, I don't know, it was like 6 or 7K burn per month or something to 20. And I just was like, oh my gosh, that's like £1,000 per working day. And just like, it just perplexed me initially because I was like, how is this model? How does this work really? And it is an interesting journey, but it's also one you need to grasp that in order to be able to sustain that, you obviously need to be solving a big enough problem and you need to be able to ultimately deliver customer value and profitability. So you kind of change your measures and the things you're looking at. You look at things like growth rate and retention and customer satisfaction and ACVs and all those kind of things. And you optimize for slightly different parts of the equation, really, rather than cash flow profitability. So that was a really interesting journey as well to take on.
Did you have any coaches or mentors help you make that transition to running a non-profitable VC-backed business, which hopefully eventually will become profitable, but that's not the kind of short-term aim when you raise the initial funding?
Yeah, loads and loads of support. That's I think another big tip I would give to all founders is like soak in as much possible support as you can. And that's from other founders, it's from business professionals, it's from coaches and mentors. So always be asking what people are doing, how they're approaching it, sharing your challenges, being very open and transparent about where you're at, because almost certainly someone else has been there and seen something similar, if not almost identical to what you're going through. And they'll be able to at least give you kind of their perspective, right? And I think one of the important things as a founder is taking counsel from lots of different sources and then ultimately making a decision up about how you're going to address it and move forward. Had a tremendous amount of support. I think we've been on 8 accelerators or something like that. So we've had a lot of support through those. We've got about 60 investors and our early angels were incredibly supportive in helping us think through some of this and kind of coaches and supporters in the right direction.
Good. I'd love to explore some of the key challenges and some of the major decisions you've taken in recent years. One of your decisions was to transition to 100% channel focus. So why did you choose to prioritize channel revenues, and how has that impacted the way your business is structured?
It's a good question. The short answer is unit economics. The longer answer is, in order for us to reach, we work with 5,000 small businesses now. That is great. And I'm sure, like, you know, I'm very proud we got there. But for me, it's still like 0.1% of what we could achieve. And therefore, we're still relatively early on what the impact we can make in the world. When we started working with customers initially directly first with a self-serve SaaS journey effectively, and that allowed us, I'd say, the biggest benefit of that was we learned a lot from our early customers. And I definitely wouldn't advise a company, unless it's a kind of a necessary of their business model or industry, to go channel first or partner first, because you lose that closeness to customer and those insights and that rapid feedback loop. So that allowed us to develop the product, to refine the messaging, to figure out what a good journey would look like, to actually make sure we were solving the problem that we thought we were solving. Where the channel and partners became incredibly effective was when we needed to scale that to many more customers. And partners have existing relationships with those customers. They've got the trust in place. And it effectively means the number of companies we need to directly engage and manage is reduced significantly. And it also means we benefit, particularly with the channel, from effectively a sales and marketing team with each of our partners. And we work with over 800 partners. So those partners are effectively our sales and marketing supercharged. It all sounds really good in principle. And I think that partnerships attracts a lot of people, a lot of attention. But the reality is it's incredibly hard and it takes a long time to actually get right. And I still say we've still got a long way to go to actually really making it work and fly. And through that journey, you learn what types of partners you should and shouldn't be working with. You learn that partners need a lot of support, and they need for everything from enablement to marketing and sales and how to deal with customers, how to fit the product into the, alongside their other things they're doing. They need nurturing. They need care. They need product features that make the platform more suitable for them and how their business works. So your product roadmap adapts, your sales team structure adapts, your operational infrastructure adapts. And it's very much a transition. And for us, we're kind of lucky because this happened over the space of a couple of years. The writing became clearer on the wall, if you like. And then we took the decision to finally transition. And that was, coming back to the short answer, that's unit economics, really. I mean, cost of acquisition to lifetime value, gross and net revenue retention through partners is superior. In fact, we've got upper decile unit economics right now because of our partner first approach. So it's definitely something I would encourage founders to explore, but I'd firstly make sure you've got your customer value prop nailed and you've kind of know what your customers want before going to partners and trying to get them to sell. If you can't sell it, they're not going to be able to sell it. That's probably the first thing. And the second thing is, don't expect quick results. It will take time. It'll take iterations. But if you can put those two things in place and eventually be willing to move to a channel first model, I think it can be really good for certain sectors, certain industries as well.
And when we last spoke, we discussed Alive in 25, which is an idea that I hadn't heard of previously. So this is ensuring that your business will survive and prosper into the year 2025 and hopefully well beyond that. So what are some of the ideas or approaches that Alive in 25 recommends for software startups and scale-ups?
I can't take credit for it. It was one of my friends that mentioned it to me. We were just having a catch up and he was like, it's all about being alive in 25. And it just stuck with me. And obviously it stuck with you as well. And it's, the context of that really is the funding market, the venture market, early stage, middle and late, is significantly down from where it used to be. And there's still activity, right? But it's going towards very either exceptional companies that are like in the upper decile of what they can and should be doing, uniquely placed, or generative AI, something hot, and people don't want to miss out on that. So the funding market has significantly changed, and it hasn't evaporated, but you have to be willing to accept lower valuation multiples. You have to temper your expectations on growth. So with that in mind, I think a lot of companies, if possible, and you can make structural adjustments, you can reduce your cash burn, like temper your growth expectations, surviving through this VC winter or funding winter is really, really important, because not only will you probably improve your business resilience and your underlying efficiency through some of the changes, but you'll also be able to attract a much better valuation at much better terms when things do come back. There are kind of different schools of thought, right? This is just a correction to normal, and we just saw an abnormal few years, and therefore this is the new normal, and we just have to accept it. I think there is pressure from the global economy, though, that is probably going to impact growth rates, and therefore you're still not going to get the kind of valuation you'll get in a year or two's time. So Alive in 25, for me at least, is really about doubling down on capital efficiency and healthy, sustainable growth, making sure that you take difficult decisions early, because they do creep up on you, and that will burn your precious cash reserve. So if you can do that, not everyone's in a position to do that, but if you can, that's definitely a good starting point.
And one of the difficult decisions you took was to downsize your C-suite from 5 people to 2, which is a pretty radical move. So how did you make that decision? How did it make you personally feel at the time? And how did you communicate your decision both to the leadership team and to the rest of the company?
It's slightly different topic to the Alive in 25. This wasn't actually about a cost reduction or trying to optimize for that part. It was really about an understanding of what are the skills and the attributes we need in the future. We've got some incredible people that have been with our company for years, you know, and for the majority of CyberSmart's lifetime. And that's part of the journey as well. My co-founder left after a couple of years as well, because we had a difference in where we wanted to take the company. And I think you need to realize where those kind of crossroads come, where you need different skills, you need to invest in different areas of the business. So it was like, I guess all decisions, it happens very slowly and then all at once. So you kind of have a lot of data points and you have feelings and you have things that pop up that, you know, we should probably be investing more in this area and we need to really double down on this and we've got a gap over here. And then ultimately it culminated in actually we do need a pretty significant shift in our leadership. And for us, it was less about trying to optimize for where we're at. It was more about where do we want to get to in the next 12, 18, 24 months, and what skills do we need to achieve that? And what are the gaps? Like we realized we weren't empowering our leadership team, our directors, our heads of as much, anywhere near as much as we should be. It was still very much a company ran by the C-suite. And that's fine, I think, in an early stage company. And when you are trying to crack really difficult problems, you need a very directive style of leadership. But I don't think it really suited what the challenges we needed to overcome and we face ahead. And I think we needed to create the environment for our team to really step up and lead. And we've managed to do that. Fast forwarding, the middle bit in the middle is horrible. It was by far the hardest decision I've had to take in the history of my working career, because these are people that you know that have been in the trenches with you forging this company through trials and tribulations, have made personal sacrifices, you know, have put in the work, and obviously that they will hopefully be rewarded for that as well. And they've hopefully had a fantastic time doing that. But still, saying goodbye to people is hard. It's one of the hardest things to do. So that bit was tough. The communications plan was the most extensive comms plan we've ever done for anything in the company. It's like, you know, 16 different steps, right? And different groups you need to bring in at different levels and understanding the impact of the decision and things that might change, as well as bringing other people on that journey emotionally and practically. So they know what's going to happen to X that was being taken care of by someone, but also like giving them the time and space to process. So it happened over the space of about 6 weeks or something like that. But it was quite extensive to try and get there. I think we did a good job. We did get a bit of feedback. People said this is the best communicated change we've been through. Thank you. It's one of the hard bits is you never really know. on the feedback piece, and it's probably been made a bigger issue from the remote first, is it's so easy for people to not, for you to not get that. Was this communicated? Do people actually understand why and what we're doing, or do they think this is some kind of thinly veiled cost reduction exercise, you know, something like that, right? And I've spent a lot of time, and it's a lot of people tell me this, but repeating yourself over and over and over. And it's like, you think as a founder, early days, I was like, I said it once, why would I ever say it again? I already told everyone the strategy for this year, you know, like 6 months in, why don't they remember what I said in January? That it just doesn't work like that. People need the constant reminder, the reframing, and also the context of why you're doing it and what you expect and how things you've learned along the year have adapted the plan now, and what does the plan look like for the rest of the year. And we've done a really good job, go to one of kind of more tactical elements around our OKR planning cycle, and we implemented something called a half time. So halfway through the quarter, we'll do a basically check-in, like, here's where we're at. That gives us that time and space to basically recalibrate for the rest of the quarter. So we're not, like, people are not running towards this thing that doesn't actually exist anymore, is not possible or feasible. That's been a nice little catch up, but people need that constant reminder. Here's what we're doing. Here's why we're doing it. Here's where we expect to get to. Here's what we've learned. Here's why the plan's changed. All those kind of bits. It's the same with communicating a change like this. I think I've spoke about it for about 3 months solid afterwards. So it's pretty much just like, oh, this, remember, this is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it.
In terms of the emotional strain on you yourself, did you practice any techniques like mindfulness, meditation, qigong, you know, to help you get through that tricky period?
It's funny you mention that, actually, because I was writing just a quick message to the team today for World Mental Health Day, and I just shared a little bit about my kind of tips and areas I focus on, and I did a bit more on this. But for me, it's kind of taking care of quite a few areas, but on a daily basis, so like exercise, nutrition, sleep. Getting some downtime. I get downtime every day. I think it's important for a founder as well. Even if it's just an hour or something like that, just get some time where you're not. I mean, it's almost impossible to not think about work, I think, but still, time where you're not actively processing what you need to do next or reflecting on something. So I think a combination of lots of daily habits, routines, get yourself a challenge outside of work, whether that's, you know, a musical one, it's a fitness one, it's, you know, it could be anything, but give yourself something else to focus on that isn't just, you know, working on your company. I mean, yeah, I don't know if we've got any non-founders listening to the podcast, but as a founder, it's consuming, I think.
One thing I have discovered over the last 6 to 8 months is the ancient Chinese practice of qigong, which combines a lot of the elements you mentioned. Grounding, nutrition, sleep, movement, etc., all in one combined approach. So I found that, yeah, to be really helpful. Might be something that you want to share with your employees.
I'll check that out. I'm an early adopter, so I track and try everything, I guess. So I will definitely give that a try and see how it works.
I'll send you some links. Although in terms of being an early adopter, it's been around for 4,000 years, but it's only it's only in the West been discovered in the last few decades. But I'll send you some links after this conversation. I want to talk about the culture of the organization. So failure can often lead to growth opportunities. So how do you encourage a culture within CyberSmart where employees feel comfortable taking risks and learning from their mistakes?
I think you need to build it into the DNA of the company. And by that, I don't mean from like you encourage it, because we used to just encourage it and talk about it a lot. That's a good, I think, foundation. And especially if you're really small, that probably works. It gets people to be willing to risk and put themselves in the uncomfortable zone and try new things. I think as you grow, that kind of starts to fade away and people revert back to more basic instincts, right? Survival of their role and not getting embarrassed and failing and, you know, and all these things that might run through their head. What I mean by like bake it into the company is you need to set up, whether you're using OKRs or 4DX or whatever framework you're using, or even a weekly tracker of your tasks and activities that build into that. So for example, we'll have core and explore type OKRs. So the core ones are things that we do already, or products we already know, markets we already serve, and we want to do better. They're usually pretty clearly defined, like we want to launch this and we want to do this and we want to improve this by 10% type thing. And then we've got our explore type activities. In our company, it's probably somewhere between about 20% of our resource goes towards these types of activities, where it's new markets, new products, and things we just don't know. There's unknowns and there's experimentation. We frame them as, this is a core an exploratory activity, and here are the hypotheses, for example, we'll use. So we actually do this on go-to-market as well as our product. Here are our hypotheses, and this is what we want to test, and this is what we could get to. And it's like, you've already set the context that this is an experiment, and there's a time frame for it, and there's an expected result. This isn't something that has to work for the company to succeed. And I think that kind of contextual frame is really important for people to take the risk and be willing to try new stuff and learn and learn from that as well. Another format we've experimented with is Skunk Works. So it comes from the Lockheed Martin factory they set up to do all their kind of stealth bombers and cool aircraft that they couldn't necessarily do in their core business because there wasn't necessarily a customer demand for it. But it was like, could be really interesting one day, right? So we set up something similar. We get a few of the team together on a Thursday and we work on something that is kind of outside the remit of what we're currently working on in our product, or we've looked at quite a few areas. So we actually looked at generative AI and use cases for product in that. And that was a research project. And we've done other things around building stuff and testing stuff. But in that space, it's pretty much like we're here to play, and you've created that environment where it doesn't really, you know, no one's measuring it, or no one's going to like report your KPIs on innovation. But it's a space where, given people the time to apply their craft and what they know and a little bit of freedom, can result in some really cool, interesting bits that can impact the broader business. So yeah, I'd say it's more structural than it is messaging. So if you're just telling people to be innovative, you'll never get innovation, but create the conditions for them to be innovative and it'll happen.
That's interesting. What's the one piece of advice you'd love to give your younger self at the beginning of your entrepreneurial journey, knowing what you now know?
That's a good question. Pick a big problem, because you're going to be at it a long time and you're going to put your heart and soul into it and make it worthwhile. I'd say that's probably kind of hand in hand with do something you're passionate about. Again, it's, you need the resilience and the persistence and determination to go the journey. And unfortunately, a lot of people struggle with journey, right? Founder is a very real thing. Founder burnout is a very real thing. And it's something I think we're almost all on the edge of, if as a founder, live on this very fine line. But having something you're really passionate about, you're motivated about, that is a big problem that you can keep coming back to your why on, allows you to sustain that. And I'd say that's probably the number one thing. I probably think of something better after this, but yeah, maybe we can put it in the outtakes.
Yeah, we'll do a separate outtakes edition. Looking ahead, what is your vision for the future for CyberSmart? How do you see the company's role in shaping the cybersecurity and insurance landscape for SMBs in the years ahead? And also related to that, are you going to stick with the SMB market, or at some point, do you see yourself moving up market towards enterprise?
Yeah, or down to consumer. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think for me personally, I just want to make I want to see the impact and the difference we can make to small businesses around the world when it comes to stopping them. The reason we started the company is this just shouldn't happen to small businesses. If they can just do these three things, then we will reduce almost all the cyber attacks that SMEs suffer. But that's a big challenge. It's a challenge that we need to collectively solve alongside the vendors that make the software, the hardware manufacturers. It's a collective change in the human psyche in order to shift the underlying economic incentives away from the criminals. So they basically doesn't make sense to attack small businesses. Just like burglary. I mean, burglary's been going down year after year because it just doesn't make economic sense for people. The risks are too high versus the reward. And I think we need to get to that state collectively. And I hope we can do it for small businesses in the next 5 years or so. For me, it's our focus as a company. And I could give you the investor answer, which has lots more milestones and deliverables. But ultimately, my focus is just focusing on delivering more customer value and helping more businesses solve this problem. And I think that's a good driving force, because everything else falls behind it, really. If we can reach more customers, we can solve the problem better than anyone else, then ultimately we do build a very successful company. So that's our immediate focus. Whether or not we'll focus on other segments in our with our current product set and our current go-to-market is very, very unlikely. The reason being, I think to crack the small business segment, you need to be dedicated to it. I think it's far too easy. If you've got SMB and you're serving mid-market or enterprise, it's far too easy to cater to those mid-market and enterprise customers. They pay far more. They are more demanding. And if you can, and usually you'll get swayed, you know, by the big bucks to go to that. A lot of cybersecurity vendors ultimately end up moving up market to that. And I think one of the things that's unique about what we do is we're dedicated to that segment, and that allows us to do it better than anyone else can, because we only do that segment. In terms of consumer, because this is actually something that pops up in the company quite often, is like, oh, we should launch a family plan, CyberSmart for Home. And where I'm always like, it's a very, very different market and a very, very different product and a very, very different user journey. So on the surface, it looks like, yeah, they need protection. But when you start to peel it back, it's quite a different challenge you're trying to solve. That being said, you never know where the CyberSmart brand could go. We've done a lot of work around thought leadership and kind of trying to challenge the perceptions on the fear, uncertainty, and doubt we talked about earlier, and make cybersecurity an empowering force for businesses. Maybe we will do that, but we're probably not going to do it with our current product and go to market. Maybe some alliances in the future.
Love your focus. I'm sure you're still going to be alive in 25, so you can come back then and tell me how your strategy has evolved over the subsequent 18 months. Jamie, thank you so much for sharing your journey with me. Wishing you and CyberSmart huge success for many years into the future.
Great. Thank you very much, Gary. Pleasure speaking with you.
This episode of the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan was brought to you by Alpina Search. Head over to www.alpinasearch.com for advice on scaling your technology startup and recruiting high-impact senior talent.